You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. My pleasure to be with you here on this Monday, February 13th. If you haven't bought your Valentine a gift, there is still time. And preaching to myself there, to be honest with you. So hopefully, sweetheart, you're not listening. But if you are, I'm on it. I promise. Please be my Valentine. And my pleasure to be here with you. As I said, no guests on the program today, so we're just going to talk, you and me. And if you've got a comment or a question, you can give me a shout. I'll give you that contact information here in just a minute. I thinking a lot over the weekend, did some reading on this whole difference between patriotism and nationalism. There's been a lot of talk about both since Donald Trump was elected to the presidency. A lot of talk about is there a difference between the two? Donald Trump, of course, ran on a campaign slogan. Got to give him at least props on the catchiness of his slogan, which was "Make America Great Again." Everybody knows that, right? I'm trying to remember what Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan was. Something about something together. I can't remember. See, that tells you right there. Whoever came up with that slogan knew what they were doing. Anyway, so make America great again. And I was somewhat critical during the campaign of that statement because I thought it implied some things that weren't necessarily the most compatible with a Christian worldview, I guess you could say, because I thought it had some undertones that were sort of dog whistly to a sort of scapegoatism of immigrants and others who somehow made America less than great. I don't know. But I want to set that aside for today. And really, I was inspired to think about this topic and to talk about this topic by a column I read over the weekend in National Review by Jonah Goldberg. Jonah Goldberg, who I talked about on Friday. Yes, I have a sometimes active man crush on Mr. Goldberg. I really like his writing. He is a conservative, and I certainly have some conservative sympathies, much to the chagrin of those who want to brand me a leftist, which I always say it's a strange world that we live in when I'm viewed as a liberal. But anyway, I have great conservative sympathies because, as I've said before, I think the Catholic faith at its essence is both conservative and liberal in the best sense of the words. Conserving, meaning that there are certain truths that are not up for grabs, no matter how fashionable they are, things worth preserving or conserving, but liberal in the sense that that God's grace and mercy extend to all persons, and human dignity is not limited to an elite few. So liberal and conservative in the best senses of each term, and of course, they both get co-opted and used in various ways. But National Review, long really a publication with a conservative bent, founded, of course, by the late William F. Buckley. And the National Review was, I thought, quite harsh in its criticisms of Donald Trump during the campaign. Many of their writers, basically, as I said during the campaign, you knew Trump had issues when he was running against Hillary Clinton and the National Review would not endorse him. So anyway, I digress. I was reading this article. Jonah Goldberg has a piece he calls the G-File, which I'm assuming is a reference to his last name, in which he kind of goes through. It's sort of it reminds me a little bit of Richard John Newhouse used to have a column like this at the end of the Journal of Religion and Public Life called First Things, while we're at it. It's sort of a wrap-up and touching on a whole bunch of topics, and he gets into this whole issue of nationalism versus patriotism. He's certainly, of course, not the first one to talk about such distinctions, one of those being the great British Catholic G.K. Chesterton. So we'll get all that in the program today. I guess you could say, in a nutshell, my viewpoint is there's a difference between nationalism and patriotism. Patriotism is a good thing, a virtuous thing. Nationalism is its distortion. Every virtue has its corresponding distortion and vice, and we'll talk about that on the program today. And certainly, since I have no guests, if you want to chime in on that, 573-4BREAD-4, you can call or text, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. We'll also talk a little bit today about the Bible's cold parenting comfort. If you're a parent, you're looking for some comfort, today's first reading in the Mass, not really for you, just saying. My question of the day, because this connects with another topic I want to talk about today, and that's some of the best Onion headlines I've seen lately. Onion, of course, the Onion, the satirical news source, which unfortunately often gets confused with a real news source. You see people share these article headlines, and people react to them as if they're truly news. But one of those, I love their kind of human interest stories, The Onion. And they had this one, man brings lunch from home to cut down on small joys. Speaking with reporters from Richmond, Virginia is the byline. Speaking with reporters while opening Ziploc baggies of pretzel twists and baby carrots, local man Stan Kepler said Monday he started bringing in lunch from home to cut down on his small joys. Quote, making your own lunch each day is a great way to reduce your simple pleasures throughout the week. It's already made a huge difference for me, the 38-year-old insurance underwriter said as he unwrapped a plain turkey sandwich from aluminum foil that he had woken up 15 minutes early this morning to prepare. I used to go out for lunch with coworkers and actually enjoy myself every day, but now I just sit at my desk and eat something I packed from home. It's quick, easy, and has cut my weekly sense of gratification by at least half. Oh, that's pretty good. So my question of the day is, what do you usually do for lunch? I'm giving you four options here. Do you usually eat out? Do you usually pack your lunch? Do you usually skip lunch altogether, or do you eat at home? 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I'll share some of the responses we've gotten on Facebook or Twitter. I remember, you know, when this issue first became a question for me was when I remember the summer, I think it was after my freshman year in college, and my mother decided I needed to make sure I had a summer job. Of course, college, you know, you get out a little earlier, early May, and I think it was mid-May. I still had not found a summer job, and my mom woke me up at about 7:15 and said, they're having interviews at Kmart at 8 o'clock. Get your clothes on and get down there. So, obedient son that I was, I did. And so I ended up getting this summer job at Kmart. It was sort of the beginning of adulting. You know, you still hold on to this illusion that you're going to have some sort of summer break. My job was 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. My first grown-up 40-hour-week job. And I had a good friend who also got hired on there, so that was nice. But early on, you know, we were going out, we had an hour lunch break, and we would go out to lunch every day. And then I started to realize, because I was basically making, shows you how old I am, I was they would pay us in cash, and it was maybe $110 a week for a 40-hour work week. That was after taxes. And so my friend and I would always go, you know, we would go out to lunch every day. We did for a while. And then I realized I was spending about $15-$20 just on lunch. So one of my rare moments of financial common sense, decided that we would pack lunch 4 days a week and then eat out on Fridays. That worked out pretty nice. Anyway, so I'll give you some of the comments other people have made in terms of whether you eat out for lunch, whether you usually pack, whether you eat at home, or do you usually just skip lunch altogether. Again, 5734-BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. 5734-BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. I watched the Grammys last night. Came home. I taught a marriage preparation class. Huge group. I guess that's a good sign. People are still getting married. 24 couples packed in a room, and they had to be in there for a little over 5 hours with me. So you can have sympathy for them. But not easy for me either because, well, I'll get into this later, teaching marriage preparation, particularly the class that I teach and where we get into some challenging issues, particularly related to sexuality. It's not for the faint of heart. But I came home last night and decided I would watch part of the Grammys with a couple of my kids. And, you know, some of it was good. I mean, Bruno Mars, very talented musician. I didn't stay up and watch all of it by any means. Some of it kind of forgettable. The Keith Urban, Carrie Underwood duet, meh. And particularly that weird attempt at a mashup between the Lucas Graham song, you know, Once I Was 7 Years Old. And then he had this Kelsey Ballerini country artist trying to sing some Peter Pan song over top of it. Major epic failure. Adele, of course, wonderful. And who was the other one I thought was extremely talented, even though half the artists I really don't know. But the weird one, Beyonce, what was that thing? It was like, it was some sort of, one of my kids said it looked like she was wearing a monstrance around her head. You know, the thing they put the Eucharist in for worship. She was pregnant in this gold glittery thing and this indiscernible, weird kind of, it reminded me of, you know, the video they show in the boat ride in Willy Wonka? That's kind of what it reminded me of. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to learn more about what we do and who we are? Check out breadboxmedia.com. Listen to our various contributors. Subscribe to podcasts, all the rest through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean. You can check out what we're trying to do. It helps spread the word. Tell people, get the app, change the world, change your life. We continue this work of walking together, sharing from our heart, and hopefully introducing you to the power and the love of Jesus Christ to transform our lives and the beauty and the richness of the faith he founded upon St. Peter and the apostles. Let's see. I was talking about that Beyonce performance last night, which seemed to last forever. Somebody I follow on Twitter, a guy by the name of Matt Jones, who actually is a local guy here in Lexington who started a whole Kentucky sports fan organization called Kentucky Sports Radio. And anyway, on that Beyonce performance, he writes, he tweets, "There comes a point when people become so famous they believe they can do anything and the world will think it's meaningful. This is that point." if you didn't see it, you need to look it up because it was bizarro. This is where, as a star, you need to always have somebody next to you who is not a sycophant, you know, somebody who will say, this really doesn't make any sense and isn't working. But unfortunately, that's not the way celebrity typically works. Again, my question of the day, what do you usually do for lunch? Inspired by the Onion article, man brings lunch from home to cut down on small joys. Do you usually pack, usually eat out, usually eat at home, or skip lunch altogether? Alex here, our producer, says he usually eats at home. That's always nice. I do that most of the time as well when I grab something, because I teach a class right around lunchtime, which is just down the street from my house. And then I can just pop in and grab a little something. Let's see what some comments we've gotten on Facebook are. And that's always an option, as well as calling or texting 573-4-BREAD-4. Doug says, do without. Brian says, pack to save time and money. John says, pack 4 days a week, eat out on Fridays as a section. There you go. Just like my old Kmart policy. Kathy says, do without. Susan says, pack. Shannon says, my husband almost always packs lunch for the week. On occasion, he will go out if his unit is celebrating something. I eat at home with the kids, except for special occasions as well. We are so over eating out for meals. Sharon says, a pack of thermos with Progresso soup light and an apple. I'm still hungry when I go back to work, but I find it keeps me from being sleepy, and I drink flavored waters whenever I get a break. Saves on cash and calories. Dave says, pack leftovers, saves time and money, eat out once a week or so. Yeah, eat out every day, man. It'll set you back, no doubt. So if you want to chime in, we'd love to hear from you. Anyway, so onto this whole question of nationalism and patriotism. So I was reading this weekend in National Review, which, as I said, is a magazine I enjoy. Not always, but some of their stuff. And Jonah Goldberg, easily my favorite writer with the magazine. And he has a column called The G-File, which he comments on various things. But there was a debate, I guess you could say, about the nature of patriotism and nationalism. I guess there was a cover article from National Review from one of the editors, Rich Lowry, in which he was arguing that nationalism is really not any different than patriotism, and therefore it's a good thing. Whereas Goldberg takes exception to that. In the cover story, Rich Lowry and Ramesh, was it Pomeroo? Is that how he's saying? Anyway, he said these two authors wrote, the vast majority of expressions of American patriotism, the flag, the national anthem, statues, shrines, and coinage honoring national heroes, military parades, ceremonies for those fallen in the nation's wars, are replicated in every other country of the world. This is all the stuff of nationalism, both here and abroad. So Goldberg responds, this is at the same time both entirely right and fundamentally misleading. It leaves out what the flag represents. It glides over the fact that the national anthem sanctifies the, quote, land of the free. Our shrines are to patriots who upheld very specific American ideals. Our statues of soldiers commemorate heroes who died for something very different from what other warriors have fought and died for millennia. Every one of them, immigrants included, took an oath to defend not just some soil, but our Constitution, by extension, the ideals of the founding. Walk around any European hamlet or capital and you will find statues of men who fell in battle to protect their tribe from another tribe. That doesn't necessarily diminish the nobility of their deaths or the glory of their valor, but it is quite simply a very different thing they were fighting for. So in this debate in the pages of National Review, Rich Lowry then responded by saying that, he says, it's a charming characteristic of American nationalism to believe that it isn't and can't possibly be nationalism. That is, for other countries, not for us. So Jonah seems to imply that other countries can't have true patriotism because they don't have the Declaration and our founding ideals. And he basically accuses Goldberg of being dismissive of the heroes of other countries, for example, whether William of Orange, Admiral Nelson, and so forth, that they really weren't patriots. They were just mere nationalists fighting for tribes. But here's what Goldberg says, and I think he does a good job with this. He said, patriotism means love of country. People all over the world love their countries. Even people who live under oppressive dictators and hate their governments will say that they love their country. And indeed, many of the greatest patriots swim against the nationalist tides in their homelands. In other words, it's really what I think Goldberg is getting at here is that to be the difference between being a patriot and a nationalist. A nationalist believes or loves his country simply for the fact that it's his country. Whereas a patriot loves the vision and the values of that country that make it great. It's hard to encapsulate, of course, an article in a radio soliloquy. But Goldberg, in many ways, even though Goldberg is not Catholic, he's not Christian, I don't believe. I'm sure he's Jewish in origin, whether he practices or not. I do not know that about Jonah Goldberg. But what he says in many ways is a lot like G.K. Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton, who was decidedly Catholic, a Catholic convert, one of the great British writers of the 19th and 20th centuries. Chesterton wrote a lot about this. And he sort of kind of, if you imagine in Chesterton's view, almost put it on a spectrum of sorts where you had these equal and opposite errors. And I think this is particularly important from the perspective of a Catholic Christian, because I think one of the real challenges that we sometimes face as Christians in the world, as people of a dual citizenship, in which our citizenship is in heaven, we are citizens of the kingdom of God, surely and purely by God's grace. We are also citizens of the land in which we live. And there's not a conflict in that sense. I mean, a true Christian should be a good citizen of whatever country he's in. That's why it's so misguided, for example, in China, where part of evidently the rub in terms of normalizing the relationship between Beijing and the Vatican is the insistence from Beijing that if this relationship becomes normalized, that there needs to be a promise that the Catholics in China are going to be true patriots. It's really a false understanding of what it means to be a Catholic. Of course, a Catholic should be a patriot. It's always a tempered patriotism, in a sense, because of where our true home lies. But ultimately, because Catholics seek to be people of virtue, they should be the best citizens of whatever land in which they reside. And so it's always this struggle. But what Chesterton basically lifts up are these two sort of equal and opposite errors. One is what he saw as globalization or globalism, an idea that sort of eliminates any distinctions between countries and cultures and nations. We've seen a trend toward this, particularly in certain, you know, elite intellectual circles over the past few decades. Kind of a reaction against the nationalism that had such bloody implications in two world wars in the 20th century. Let's extol the virtues of globalization. But Chesterton thought that was misguided, which I think is rooted in the Catholic understanding of subsidiarity and the fact that we should love those close to us. We'll be back with more of this on the other side of the break. We'll talk about the opposite extreme from globalization. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show.
Here on Breadbox Media. Again, my question today, what do you usually do for lunch? Usually pack, usually eat out, eat at home, or skip lunch altogether? 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Still smarting yesterday from a painful evaluation I received at the end of a marriage preparation class. I teach this class about 10 times a year. It's called God's Plan for a Joy-Filled Marriage. It's a one-day class. It takes about 5.5 hours. And it's one of the steps in the marriage preparation process for engaged couples here in our diocese. It's part of a marriage preparation process we put in place a little over 10 years ago. The purpose of the God's Plan for a Joy-Filled Marriage class is to give couples, as I would say, a vision of what marriage is. There are other aspects of marriage preparation, what you may have heard of before, like a pre-Cana class, that's oftentimes called, in which they might learn certain, you know, practical relationship skills like communication, how to make a budget, dealing with the in-laws, how to resolve conflict, et cetera, et cetera. But the purpose of the class that I teach, which is really supposed to be the first of the components of the marriage preparation, is helping them to have a vision that will sustain them of what marriage is and what married love is and what sexual love means. I've equated it before to, you know, mountain climbers who allegedly make the most progress on the days they can see the summit. On those days, they can deal with adversity, they can overcome exhaustion. There's a purpose in their stride because they see where they're going. But on the days in which it's shrouded with mist, the pinnacle, they become more disheartened. They turn on each other. They're ready to quit. And so the goal of the God's Plan for a Joy-Filled Marriage class is to give these couples a vision of marriage that will sustain them, what it means to be married, why God made marriage in the first place, its role in our lives, and what our sexuality means, because marriage is the sexual sacrament. And so we wade into some pretty turbulent waters, not from the get-go. We kind of lay a foundation. The idea is you lay this foundation so that they kind of understand the meaning of marriage and the meaning of the sexual union which consummates marriage. Then you start dealing with the implications. It's a little bit of a... it's not deceptive, but it sort of lays out the case so that then when you get to the implications, all of a sudden, it's hard to find a place to hide, because the truth is most of us have been shaped and formed with an entirely different vision and view of what our sexuality even means. Anyway, so we wade into some difficult waters, but try to do it in a way, again, we use the language of proposal they should be familiar with. The Catholic faith really can only ever be proposed, not imposed, and so no one's coming around their house with a clipboard to see whether they're embracing this vision of marriage. Anyway, we always do evaluations at the end of it, anonymous evaluations. So we had, 48 total people, as I get 48 evaluations back of the day. The vast majority, very positive, which is good. I'm glad to hear that. Part of my goal in teaching it is that if they reject Catholic teaching, at least make sure that it's for the right reasons, because they've understood it clearly, what Catholic teaching is, not a caricature, and there's been nothing in my personal presentation that has been so offensive that that's the reason they reject it. And so I work really hard at that, you know, try to be very self-effacing and as tender as I can be. So the vast majority of the evaluation is very positive. But why is it that the negative ones stick with you? I got one yesterday that first time I've ever been told this, attending this seminar was like watching paint dry. Wow. That was a good one. Thanks for that. course, you know, you're always going to get those. And yeah, I mean, certainly, obviously, I mean, I'll take it to heart. But, you know, you're going to have those couples who come in quite, and I had this yesterday, whose backs are turned to you the entire time. Never turn around. They make it very clear that being there is like enduring traffic school. What can you do? Anyway, back to this whole question of patriotism and nationalism. As I said, if you look on a spectrum, I think, and I think this is a little bit where Jonah Goldberg is going in his piece in the National Review, which I just posted a link to it on the show's Facebook page. But he really, in many ways, mirrors, even though Goldberg himself not a Catholic, what Chesterton wrote back in articles like A Defense of Patriotism. He talks about, in a sense, this spectrum, really, where you've got globalism or globalization way over here on one side, which some, I think, Catholics believe is the way to go. We are citizens of heaven. You know, we therefore don't talk about national boundaries or our own cultures or whatever. Everything is sort of equalized and leveled out. But I think that misses something. I think we are people of a particular place, and we should come to love the best things about the place where we live. And cultures are different. I mean, part of what we've had, I think, with this recent election here, I think with the Brexit vote in Great Britain, is a reaction against this sort of blurring of cultural differences. Because diversity, authentic diversity, is not about the elimination of differences. It's about mutual respect of our differences. And so you've got globalization, which can become its own false god. But then you've got, in the words of Chesterton, you've got the other extreme, which is nationalism, which is really sort of an unconditional devotion and approval of your country just because it's your country. Chesterton said this, one of his all-time great quotes. He said, "My country, right or wrong, is a thing that no patriot would think of saying except in a desperate case. It's like saying my mother, drunk or sober." He says, "No doubt if a decent man's mother took to drink, he would share her troubles to the last. But to talk as if he would be in a state of gay indifference as to whether his mother took to drink or not is certainly not the language of men who know the great mystery." So patriotism in this view, which is a view that I share, is that place, that right place of balance between those two extremes, between a globalization that would eliminate all concern with one's immediate neighbor. Chesterton took aim at that in a poem he called The Judgment of England. He said in this poem, I get to the very end of it here, "The villas and the chapels where I learned with little labor the way to love my fellow man and hate my next door neighbor." So we can have this tendency, right, to have this great global vision and miss the subsidiarity, the closeness of those who are near to us, and to appreciate and to love the best things about our country and the vision upon which our country was founded. Nationalism is an almost tribal idea. This is why, you know, I'll say, when we get into topics, for example, I think the anniversary of the bombing of Dresden was last week. Not one of our country's finest moments, I must say. The firebombing of Dresden's, the firebombing of Tokyo, the dropping of the atomic bombs, what happened at Abu Ghraib, the torture, and so forth. To question those things, the virtue in those things, is not to be unpatriotic. Rather, to affirm those things without any moral qualm, I think, is a mark of nationalism. It's my country, right or wrong, my mother drunk or sober. And so I think we've had a reaction against the sort of globalization of the left, which, you know, Barack Obama was a face of in many ways, and decrying so-called American exceptionalism and so forth. And I think in many ways, we, as we tend to do as human beings, we have veered, we're in danger of veering across the road into the opposite ditch. And we've got this problem with our political parties as well. My party, drunk or sober. But you can love one's party, you can love one's country, but love that vision which ultimately is distinctive to that country's vision. That's the key thing, I think. Anyway, but you're welcome to chime in if you think differently. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. When we come back from the break, I want to share some of my favorite recent Onion headlines. I've already shared one with you. And also talk about the Bible's cold comfort for parents. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to BreadBox Media.
You are listening to BreadBox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. BreadBox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show.
Got a question or a comment? 573-4-BREAD-4. I got a feeling I'll be unpacking and talking about this whole issue of nationalism and patriotism throughout the week. I'm going to have a local Republican politician on at the end of this week. We'll talk a little bit more about that too on Friday, but we'll be touching on it, I'm sure, here and there. I think it's an important distinction to make, particularly in the era of Donald Trump, because, as I said, we can there are these two equal and opposite heirs of sort of globalization on the one hand, nationalism on the other. And it's typically, as is true, ideas have consequences. Took off a half day on Friday and took my wife to go see the movie Hidden Figures. If you've not seen that yet, go see it while it's still in theaters. Really, really well done film, based on true events, as these films usually say, about three black women, scientists, mathematicians, who found themselves with important roles in the early days of the space race at NASA. Kevin Costner also in it, does a fine job. But it's one of the, I think, 10 films nominated for Best Picture. I think I've seen about half of them now, which may be a record for me. Shows you my kids are getting a little bit older. I still have a long way to go when it comes to pop music because, as I said, I watched the Grammys last night, at least part of it, and half the nominees I had never even heard of. So I had my 19-year-old daughter in the room to help me out. Anyway, with our question of the day, which was inspired by an Onion headline, it was about what you do for lunch every day, whether you pack, eat at home, go without, or eat out. It was inspired by this little Onion. The Onion, of course, a satirical website headline. Man brings lunch from home to cut down on small joys. Accompanied, of course, by a picture of a bearded guy in flannel staring blankly at his head, biting into what appears to be maybe a turkey sandwich of some sort, looking somewhat bland. Looks like one of those people. You ever go to McDonald's or Wendy's or something, and you're sitting there, and in comes the person who's by themselves. They're going to eat their lunch, which is fine. They sit down to eat with no newspaper, No book, no device to look at. They just sit there and stare blankly into space while they eat their meal one bite at a time. It's just not me. I got to have something. Maybe it's my ADD. I got to have something to do. Anyway, that's what that picture reminded me of. Some other recent Onion headlines that I thought were pretty funny. This one from the other day, Super Bowl 51, looking back at the greatest first half in Falcons history. Oh, gosh. I'm sorry, Falcons fans. Too soon? The pain may still be rough there. I like this one, too. Conscience quietly let go as Paul Ryan policy advisor. Paul Ryan, who's a Catholic and who has at times talked about his desire to bring Catholic social teaching and the principles of Catholic social teaching to bear on his economic policies. But of course, he's like many Republicans caught in this place of, you know, the guy who's in the White House, the guy who changed the whole political game, it seems like, in Washington, and has led now to a majority of Republicans in the Senate, House, and to have the White House. So what do you do? Are you a man of principle, or do you try to cozy up to the commander-in-chief? So anyway, it says this in this article about Paul Ryan. Acknowledging the longtime aide's many years of service, that would be conscience, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced Tuesday that his conscience would no longer serve as a key policy advisor. Quote, while my conscience has played an important role in helping me develop a number of policies to this point, it will nevertheless be stepping down from the position effective immediately. Oh, that's pretty wickedly funny. And then the last one that jumped out to me says this. This is the headline. Explanation of board game rules peppered with reassurances that it will be fun. Accompanied by a picture of some people gathered around a table with a game in front of them. It looks like it's this game Ticket to Ride, which I've read a little bit about, never played it. And somebody trying to explain with a big rule book how to play the game. Byline here, Schenectady, New York. Repeatedly seeking to ease his friends' growing skepticism and disinterest. Local man Joel Mayhew peppered his explanation of the rules of the board game Pandemic with reassurances that it will be fun. Sources confirm Friday. Yeah, some of these games. Now, Will, the exception here is Settlers of Catan. It's a little bit of a complicated game, but once you learn it, it's pretty fun. But nevertheless, that's a great headline. The first reading for today. Not a lot of comfort for parents. Story of Cain and Abel, Genesis chapter 4. You know, we're here in these last few weeks of ordinary time. Actually, 2 weeks from Wednesday would be Ash Wednesday. And so we're walking through the early chapters of Genesis. I think we go all the way up through Genesis chapter 11 before Lent. We've just had the fall of humanity. And now you've got the pain of the first family. Now, if you've never thought about it before, the book of Genesis is really a book about families. It's one of the reasons I love it so much. Unfortunately, we see the best and the worst in family life, and we see the downward spiral of sin and how badly our families need redeeming. But it goes way back. So you have the birth of Cain. The man had relations with his wife Eve. She conceived and bore Cain, saying, I've produced a man with the help of the Lord. Next, she bore his brother Abel. And so then we go into, you know, the whole thing about how Cain was a tiller of the soil. Abel was a keeper of the flocks, a shepherd. He brought one of the best firstlings of his flock as sacrifice. So we already see the sort of sacrificial system becoming part of faith life. Cain's offering of the fruit from his land was not. And the scripture's kind of cloudy about why Cain's wasn't accepted. A lot of us speculated, well, Abel brought the best, Cain just brought some. But I don't think it's quite that explicit. But nonetheless, the whole question becomes, how will Cain respond to this. In fact, the Lord says to Cain directly, "Why are you so resentful and crestfallen?" And this is one of the great lines about the nature of sin here, which sin has just entered the human equation in the chapter earlier. If you do well, you can hold up your head, but if not, sin is a demon lurking at the door. His urge is toward you, yet you can be his master. Boy, that ought to go up, carved in wood in every home around, you know? Sin is a demon lurking at the door. His urge is toward you, yet you can be his master. Unfortunately, sin gets the better of Cain. He attacks his brother Abel and kills him. That horrible, sneering, snarky comment Cain gives to the Lord when he's asked about where his brother Abel is. "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" But we see this great pain. I mean, in a sense, Adam and Eve lost both their sons. They lost one to murder and the other who became a murderer. I've always wondered which would be worse as a parent, to have your child murdered or to have your child murder someone else. So on the one level, you think this is maybe a little bit comforting because you can see, you know, here you've got the original people created by God. You know, and here their firstborn son is a murderer. So for parents who struggle with a child's misbehavior and destructive choices, there's a little comfort here that it's as old as sin itself. But at the same time, it's sort of a cold comfort because it tells us that we can do all we can do. We can pray and call upon the grace of God, but ultimately these human persons we're raising, they are free moral agents. And they can decide as they will. This parenting business, not for the faint of heart. Let's spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel. We got a little over a minute left. And let's go to random.org, our random number generator. We'll enter in a minimum number of one, max of 2865. That's the total number of paragraphs in this great repository of the faith. 1602, we've dialed up. Knowing, of course, that truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. Marriage in God's plan. How nice, since I taught on this yesterday. Sacred Scripture begins with the creation of man and woman in the image and likeness of God and concludes with a vision of the wedding feast of the Lamb. Scripture speaks throughout of marriage in its mystery, its institution, and the meaning God has given it, its origin and its end, its various realizations throughout the history of salvation. The difficulties arising from sin and its renewal in the Lord and the new covenant of Christ and the church. One of the things I talked about yesterday was, you know, the catechism hints there, the Bible from beginning to end is a book about marriage. You've got this original marriage, man and woman made in his image. You've got this final marriage, the book of Revelation, this vision of a marital supper, the great wedding feast. And really, it's these bookends that form the lens through which we see the whole of salvation history. Christ who comes as the great bridegroom to lay down his life for his bride. What's the fundamental message? God's desire is to marry us, to live in an eternal, ecstatic, life-giving, exclusive union with us. What will we do with that invitation? Be back with you tomorrow. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.